biological, reproducible life on some other place besides planet Earth. It's going to expand our thinking in some very unusual ways. And so, as I see it, we're going to be humbled one more time. We're not the only place that's got life. And of all the life that's out there, I'm convinced half of it is behind us in technological progress, and half of it's ahead of us. That's a very nice place to be in the middle. We're not the head of the pack. We're not the last guy in the pack. We're somewhere in the middle, running this crazy race, as I see it. Mel, I think you're going to come back down to Earth. What do you think, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW.
MTO, Dick, you have something for follow-up questions?
Yeah, after we deal with Mel, we'll come back to you, and we'll do a little bit more on neutralization techniques of amplifiers to give them unconditional stability and more desirable tuning characteristics. K2KEY, you got it, Mel.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Yeah, we can get back to neutralization. I can give you a little bit more insight into it. And I've had a bit of experience, I should say, with it. Oh, you were asked about, before we go any further, you asked what determines the approximate radius of the size of the Hubble. They have it here in this little article that's over.
Yeah, go ahead. How do they decide on the size of Hubble and therefore the size of the cargo hold of the space shuttle? And those two programs were lockstep with each other. You got it, Mel.
Okay. Yeah, they said the Hubble size has to be the size of a that to occupy a railroad car in a proper bracket. This determines the size of the shuttle, of the Hubble. It also has to fit properly into the shuttle's bay, cargo bay. So the shuttle's cargo bay also was determined, also because most of the equipment that would carry would have to be most likely shipped by railroad car. So they took advantage of the maximum size of a railroad car available, and this determined the size of the Hubble and also the shuttle cargo bay. Dick, over.
Thank you. Yeah, that sounds good. In the case of the external tank that's used on the space shuttle, I think they ship that in by barge because it's too big to be shipped by railroad car. I believe most of the battleships ever made by the United States are only approximately 12 feet. No, it can't be. 120 feet. 120 feet wide, because our Navy has to work in both the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean, and as such it has to be able to go through the Panama Canal locks, which are very close to 120 feet wide. I think the number was 120 feet, and therefore our battleships are 119 feet and 6 inches, something like that. Real close shave when they go through. Back to you, Mel.
I believe the battleships are held to 97 feet. I remember reading that. Because, like you say, because we're involved in both the Atlantic and Pacific. So, in other words, if the battleships were any wider, in order for the battleship to be transferred from either the Pacific back to the Atlantic or vice versa, especially if it happened in World War II, would have to go around the long way around South America. So, the constraints were, I believe, 97 feet, Dick, over.
Yeah, sounds about right. So, go ahead with the mailbag or any other subject you think we should be discussing, Mel, go ahead.
Okay. Let's see. All right, we'll leave the neutralization. I was going to say a few words about neutralization, but we'll leave that. I think we've finished with the Hubble. I got a whole bunch of things here. Hubble, boy. Quite a piece of machinery. Very, very, very complicated, but quite impressive. Let's see. Look through, see something that I can put out on the air without losing my hand license. Okay, let's see. I always look for stuff from young people. Here's one from a young person. Been a ham just recently in the last month, and I went to a ham fest. I bought some insulators, and they look like the insulators my Elmer uses, except his are all glass. Got insulators from way back. He will not part with any because he can't, but he has so few of glass insulators. And these are made out of a material called Baron, I believe it is. Delrin. No, I believe it's the, he wrote it incorrectly. He must have meant Delrin, D-E-L-R-I-N, not D-E-I-R-I-N. Delrin. And he wants to know, is it okay to use this? Because he says my illness sort of shakes his head. Well, this is all available, but I would prefer the glass, so. Want to make a comment on that, Dick?
Yeah, sure do. What we're really talking about here is insulating properties and what's called dielectric loss tangent. Fancy way of saying where to get hot in a microwave oven. Glass is the tradition for insulators of the old-fashioned style. Modern-day style is a lot less expensive to make them out of various elastomer materials, various kinds of plastic materials. Delrin is a very high-quality plastic material for radio purposes. Only one step, in my mind, below the quality of Teflon. And Teflon as a radio material is really superior. You go to any of the good books which will rate for you the radio loss of various materials, and I think the number for Teflon is something like 0004 or 0004, very, very small loss, where water is 10, and some of the plastics are much, much worse in loss. But what happens when a radio signal is applied to a so-called insulating material? Let's backtrack. I can first put my ohmmeter, or a mega device, a device that's able to measure multiple megohms of resistance. I can put it across a insulating material and measure the quality of insulation at DC frequencies. And many materials, like for instance, Texan, T-E-X-I-N, I think it's a material, with your ohmmeter, you think it's a great material. Put that material in a microwave oven alongside of a glass of water, and the Texan, Texan 240, I think it was one of the plastics I tested a couple of years ago, and it runs very hot, like a dummy mode. What's going on in there is that on each half cycle of the radio wave of the microwave oven, the individual molecules and the orbits of the electrons around it, because the molecules are slightly polarized, the molecules try to twist back and forth and follow the instantaneous polarity of the radio wave. And certain materials do it with lag. In other words, they try to follow, and they do it in a sloppy manner, so to speak. That represents power dissipation. So when you put a strong radio field across certain kinds of plastics and certain kinds of rubbers, they will run hot. And the microwave oven test is a very simple way of getting a handle on that. It's not exactly traceable to zero, but it's a good go-no-go test. You put Teflon and a glass of water in the microwave oven, and turn it on for 30 seconds, the water will get hot, the Delrin will run cold. Teflon would run ice cold. Plexiglass would run ice cold. Certain kinds of plastic would start absorbing your hand. You turn up the microwave oven, you put your hand on the material, and you get a very quick test as to what is the radio loss. The bottom line is Delrin is a beautiful material. If it was exposed to ultraviolet light outdoors, in some number of years, it probably will deteriorate in ways that glass will not. So when it comes to longevity, the Delrin might not be as long as you'd like, but there is a so-called ultraviolet version, ultraviolet protected version of Delrin, which I have used. The so-called RIW-19 antennas used to use ultraviolet protected Delrin shoulder bushings, where each one of the elements mounted through the boom, and they seem to last for a significant number of years. Not perfect, but not bad. So radio-wise, that insulator is perfect, and whether or not it's going to last 10 or 20 years is the only thing we're discussing here. And I don't think that's a serious problem for your new amateur radio operator. K2KEY, H-U-L-I-W.
Hey, very good. I figured we'd say to him, go ahead and use the insulator. Nothing's going to happen. And take the YouTube signal. It's going to explode or burn or anything, you know, to do any damage to your radio. And I know years ago, the old timers had those available of glass insulated, what they call door chrome insulator, and there was plenty of them available, very cheap. They bought them for a nice nickel piece, and of course, it was the available material at the time, and now we have some new materials, but I think it'll work just as well as the glass insulated, correct?
Absolutely. I have on occasion tried to make a center insulator for my dipoles, where it supplied support for the coax cable, allowed me to build a circuit there, as well as insulate the two halves of the wire that go to the right and left of the dipole. I took a appropriate thick piece of, I think it was quarter inch thick piece of plexiglass, drilled holes in it. The two holes up at the top on the left side and the right side are where the two halves of the dipole went, and other holes down further allowed me to put the tie wraps through to support the coax cable. So you can make your own insulators out of a lot of very available materials, and plexiglass is one of the very good ones. Back to you, Mel.
It's also good for the clandestine antennas, you know, that you have to put up sometimes, and you want an insulator that's not easily seen, so a piece of plexiglass works real well in that situation. Okay, any other further words? Anybody questions about insulators, or we can go on?
And by the way, plexiglass is one kind of clear plastic material. Another very strong, clear plastic material is called, all of a sudden I've forgotten the name. My goodness. Why did I forget? It'll
sand.
Say again?
Black sand, maybe that's a brilliant name.
Lexan is close, but polycarbonate. Polycarbonate is the general generic term.
Is that Rexolite?
Rexolite is another extremely good material for short periods of time. Rexolite, when exposed outdoors with ultraviolet, does start turning yellow and starts losing its strength. So Rexolite's okay for a period of time. I would much prefer polycarbonate and plexiglass. Back to you, Mel. And by the way, was that Barry I just heard?
Good evening, Dick. Yes, it was. How are you doing?
Okay. How much of our astronomy session have you heard so far?
I've been listening for about 25 minutes. Very interesting.
Okay, glad to hear it. You got it, Mel.
Okay, so there you are. No problem with the Dahlgren type insulated. I know I've seen them. They're white colored, but look, just like the dog bone one, the glass one, but made out of this material. All righty, let's see. I'm going through, and I'm looking very carefully to see if I can find Buster. Okay, here's another one. Ah, this is perfect for you. My friend has got involved with microwave, and recently he started making small rectangular forms. And he says that the reason that he's making it a rectangular horn rather than a round horn, he says because the advantage of a rectangular horn provide more control of the radiation pattern. What is the story on this? Can you help me what he's talking about? Because I can't seem to understand this, really what he's talking about. I think he's referring to both E. I would think he's referring to both the E and the H plane. Over.
Yeah, that's an interesting subject. Traditional waveguide is rectangular, cross-section. Almost always the height is one-half the width, almost exactly a two-to-one ratio. WR90, for instance, WR90 waveguide is nine-tenths of an inch wide and 0.45 inch high, internal dimension, and it's rated for 8.4 to 12.4 gigahertz, industry standard. If you go into your Home Depot or Lowe's store, or any other good hardware store, and buy 3/4 inch diameter copper water pipe, and you use it as waveguide at 10 gigahertz for the ham band, it has lower loss than the traditional rectangular waveguide. The round waveguide has certain advantages. It's got a couple of disadvantages. For much of traditional reasons, it's not popular. It could have been if people realized it was lower in loss. In the days when they were making the standard decisions, I think they didn't have as much available test equipment in order to confirm this. So, if I built a horn that's round or I built a horn that's rectangular, if you're smart enough, There's nothing stopping you from making the round horn elliptical in shape. And therefore you can have the guide feeding the horn be elliptical. The horn itself could be elliptical. You have the ability, if you're smart enough with geometry and laying out pieces of sheet metal on a flat bench, on a flat table before you roll it into the shape you want, you can control the flare angle horizontal of an elliptical horn, and you can control the flare angle vertical of the horn. In the case of a rectangular horn, I'll admit the mathematics on the flat sheet is easier to control the flare angle horizontally and the flare angle vertical. So in a rectangular horn, it's easier to do that. Now, a rough rule of thumb, if you take the horizontal dimension of the mouth of the horn, that primarily determines the gain and beam width. The total area of the mouth of the horn plugged into a particular formula will allow you to estimate the gain of the horn in dB over isotropic. You could rate it in units of dB over dipole if you wanted to, but the microwave people almost never do that. They like isotropic as a comparison. You can estimate, a good rough estimate of the beam width of the antenna is 70 degrees divided by the number of wavelengths of that dimension. If the horizontal mouth of my particular horn, rectangular horn, was 10 wavelengths wide, I divide 10 into 70, I come up with 7. Rough rule of thumb, a 10 wavelength wide horn will have approximately 7 degrees of beam width. And because you can change the flare angle horizontally and vertically, I have somewhat of an independent control of the horizontal and vertical beam width. I'm simplifying things here a little bit, but it's close, ballpark figures. So, does a horn have to be rectangular? If you're smart enough, I guarantee you can make an extremely high performance horn that's quasi-round or elliptical, and you can control the horizontal and vertical beam width if you wish to. There's certain advantages in doing that. In the case of feeding a parabolic dish antenna with the highest possible efficiency, the round horns do a better job than the rectangular horn. The difference is not huge, but it is there. The really high efficiency horns, like the one you've got in front of the 18-inch dish that does direct satellite reception, or the one that was in front of your 12-foot diameter dish that used to do the S-band satellite reception, both of those horns just happen to be round with a bunch of rings around it. It's called the chaparral technique, the chaparral design, and those rings around it are a bunch of chokes which do a little bit more control of the beam width, and they also act as RF chokes to make sure that excess RF energy doesn't crawl down the outside of the horn and go down the outside of the waveguide, which would complicate the primary pattern of the horn. So although a lot of traditional people may think you only have control in rectangular, a modern day person really should challenge that philosophy, because that philosophy is no longer completely up to speed, in my opinion. Now back to you, Mel, KQLIW.
Okay, sounds like a good explanation. So can we boil it down and say that the aperture might be narrow in one dimension, providing a broad beamwidth, and larger in the other dimension, making the beam width narrower. Would that be a good statement?
Absolutely. As long as you don't make the flare angle too drastic, you could make a horn that is 10 wavelengths wide in both mouth dimensions, 10 wavelengths wide horizontally, and 1 wavelength wide vertically. Therefore, the antenna would have a horizontal beam width of 7 degrees, and a vertical beam width of nearly 70 degrees, 10 to 1 ratio. That would look like a vertical diva tail in space. If you plotted the antenna pattern on modern-day computer-generated graphics, which is showing you the three-dimensional antenna pattern, it would look like a vertical diva tail. Or you could take that whole horn and lay it on its side, and it would look like an ordinary diva tail in pattern. On its side, it would be very narrow vertically and very wide horizontally. And so you have that independent control. And in certain circumstances, that's a desirable antenna. Now back to you, Bill.
Okay, the explanation on it. Just curiosity, 136. If you have a very long horn, does it affect the SWR, would be maybe very mechanically unstable? Would that, you know, I was thinking about that, and I can see, by making the horn longer, you would be able to reduce the SWR, I would assume. Is that a method of tuning that's correct, over?
Yeah, I think what you're talking about now is a very gentle flare angle. That's what you mean by a long horn. I mean, we usually design a horn for a particular mouth diameter. That's what sets the gain and beam width. And now, how do you get to that mouth diameter? You can have a very wide flare angle from the feeding waveguide, or a very gentle, very narrow flare angle, which makes it a long horn. The long horn tends to have a broader beam width and a more gentle standing wave ratio, a curve. When you plot the standing wave ratio versus frequency, the long horn tends to be more controlled. The horn with a very wide flare angle tends to be more bumpy in its standing wave ratio versus frequency. However, if you and I cared only about one particular frequency, 10.368 gigahertz, which is the main calling frequency on the 3-centimeter ham band, if you only cared about that one frequency, then with the right kind of tuning procedure, you could make essentially any flare angle at that one frequency give you whatever desirable standing wave ratio you want. You may not be completely happy with the pattern. If you go to the appropriate chapter of a book, I can't think of the name of it right now. It's an old 1950 McGraw-Hill book. That book on that microwave technique. It's not Marino I'm thinking of. It's another book, quite a bit fatter. It's got about 5 consecutive pages of various horns. Wide, narrow, high, tall, wide flare angle, narrow flare angle, and the antenna pattern of all of those horns is plotted in that book. So by choosing the right book, and if you want, I can go to my bookcase and pick up the book and tell you the author and title. You can find out which horn shapes, let's say, are successful. There's quite a bit of history behind all that. You don't have to reinvent that wheel. You can also go to the W1 gigahertz website. That's by a good buddy, Paul Wade. Lives in Massachusetts. Used to live in New Jersey. 51GolfHotelZulu.com, I think it is. Or just Google 51GolfHotelZulu. You will find a so-called online microwave book with lots and lots of chapters of all kinds of good microwave information. And one of the significant chapters in that online book by Paul Wade is how to design rectangular feed horns with the plotted patterns and swept standing wave ratios and things like that. He even lays it out on a flat sheet of metal for you, so you just blow up your picture, so to speak, make a Xerox of it, lay it with carbon paper on your piece of copper or galvanized, and cut it out to the right shape and fold it, and there comes a feed horn. A smart guy can do that in a fraction of an hour. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, very good. This is K2KEY. Basically, can we then say that the best horn, or the optimum high horn, would be one that gives us the maximum gain for the amount of material that we need?
Well, that's a tough one. Lots and lots of people have said, gee, I want to use the minimum amount of copper sheet, but I want the maximum bang for the dollar of my horn. And should I do it with a very wide flare angle that uses very little copper, or should I do it with a very gentle flare angle which uses a lot of copper? There's some advantages and disadvantages of each. The best I could recommend is that you look at those pictures in this book that I'm going to tell you about pretty soon, which shows you the successful and not so successful Pete Horn shape. Numbers of people have gone through very long, very gentle flare horns, hoping they would have higher amount of gain from the same throat area. In general, they were disappointed. They also would think that we'd get a much smaller amount of curvature of field. Therefore, the horn would be more collimated if it was more gentle in its flare angle. With moderate success, that has been partially true. However, the horns that have the best possible performance are the so-called, they're called hybrid horns. They're the horns that have a whole series of choke rings inside the horn. It's a difficult fabrication problem. I'm having trouble remembering the exact name of these horns. But it's the kind of horn that has a whole bunch of rings on the inside, quarter wave choke rings, which removes all surface current on the inside of the horn. The horn still guides the wave, but it doesn't have any surface current in the process of doing it. And you end up with a much more collimated wave, and you end up with more gain for the amount of throat area. But you expend quite a bit of effort making all those internal rings to do it. Back to you, Mel. KQRIW.
Yeah, roger, yeah. Those pyramidal horns, I know they can do some fancy work inside of that. All right, very good. Sounds like the sort of covered pretty good, basically, horn. Anybody have any questions before we go on?
And by the way, when it comes to a parabolic dish antenna, whether your overall antenna ends up high in performance or yucky in performance, is a matter of approximately two things. One, the parabolic dish itself, the reflector, does it have any bumps in it? Does it have accuracy? If the parabolic dish reflector has high accuracy, and even if it doesn't, a smart ham will build a template out of cardboard, hold it up against the surface, find out where the high spots and the low spots are, and he'll hammer those out with a ball peen hammer. Or if it's made out of mesh, he goes in there with his needle-nose pliers and corrects it. So a smart ham can take a low-quality parabolic reflector and correct it. The second big factor as to whether or not your parabolic dish antenna works is, was the horn designed to be compatible for that particular dish? The dish might have a very shallow depth to it, which is called the large focal length to diameter ratio. The higher performance, more modern dishes do that. Or you could have a very deep dish with a very small focal length to diameter ratio, like 0.25. So the old-fashioned dishes used to be close to the 0.25 in F over D. The more modern dishes are 0.6 in F over D. Much more flatter, longer focal length. At first it sounds like a disadvantage, but when you take a look at the extremely high performance feed horn, like the Turin feed horn, T-U-R-R-I-N, Dr. Dick Turin, W-2-I-M-U, invented it, so-called dual-mode horn, the horn has much higher efficiency and better feeding characteristics, and if you combine it with a 0.6 dish, you end up with a parabolic antenna assembly that works much, much better. So if at all possible, try to find the flatter dishes. 0.6 F over D. K2KEY, KQRIW.
Okay, very good. And yeah, if you want to look more into insight, as Dick had said earlier, go to W1GHZ together. And Paul, GHZ, did a whole series of articles, I remember reading in QEX. And he has also the availability, I believe it's online. Is that the one that's online, the antenna? Microwave antenna book, Dick?
Yeah. Sorry about that. Yes, that's the one that's online. I'm in the process of walking over to my bookcase to get that book, so I'll be away from the rig for the next 45 seconds or so. Mel, go ahead.
Okay, very good. You're looking for the book. We'll look for something else here. All right. Thank you very much for that comment. Whoever asked that, call the names on the bottom of it. Roberts. Okay, Roberts. I think we sort of gave you somewhat of an insight. That makes sense. If you're interested a little bit more, you can go to W1GAZ and read all about it. Now, let's see. What else can I find here? What else am I looking for? Oh, yes. Here I had mentioned in previous. Yes, I had mentioned. We once talked about this. How to build. I built a transmitting booth for a friend of mine out of copper pipe that we purchased at Home Depot. And the method I used of tuning was two pieces of pipe actually sitting right next to each other. It was two lengths of pipe were at the top of this thing where they came together next to each other. We used a plastic screw, and by tightening or loosening that plastic screw, you move the two pieces of pipe either closer or further apart. Now the question here is, with this method you have, okay, what is the typical bandwidth without having to readjust? Well, it's not too big, I'll say that much. A typical bandwidth, I believe, if I remember, this was made for 20 meters. This antenna we built would be made it for 20 meters. And I remember that the typical bandwidth was about 20 kilohertz. In other words, from the center point where it's tuned, you can tune about 10 either side of that particular spot before you'd have to touch it up. So how about the dimensions of it, I think I went through all this. The basic dimensions was about, it was 20 inches, let's see, 20 inches, I gotta remember how it was. It was 20 by, I don't remember, I think it stood, the whole thing stood about less than 3 feet tall, if I remember. And the shape was basically... sort of like a, I don't know how to describe it. I don't know what kind of shape it is. It was, you would say, narrow at the bottom and then wider at the top with using, in other words, we couldn't bend this piece of pipe. We were thinking originally making some kind of a trick to try to bend a piece of copper pipe into a circular type or, you know, just bend the corners. But I couldn't think of any way of doing it without kinking it, so we wound up using 45-degree angles and 90-degree angles, elbows, and that's how it's put together. I could say that I have to dig up my original, I may have it filed somewhere, my design on this thing, but it worked quite well for this person in the city. It was made, it was 3/4 inch, I remember, thin wall, called Type M, like Mary, cup pipe. Everything was standard nearby in Home Depot. Everything came out of Home Depot, literally, except that plastic screw, I think, we found it in our scrap pile. And a piece of wood on the bottom was a piece of scrap that's the mounting bracket. So, that's all I can recall about it. If you need more details, you want to pursue it, I can follow up with another email, and I can see if I can dig it up, the dimensions and everything, give you a sketch. That's the best I can think of right now. Back to you, Dick.
I think the M pipe is the one with the thickest, the thinnest wall thickness. K pipe is the one with the very thick tip. Walls that's intended for direct burial. So the copper pipe of an older house that comes straight into the house was K-pipe, and the pipe itself in the house is the M-type pipe. Okay, the book that I'm talking about that has a very good microwave diagram, whatever, is called Southworth. It's Southworth. Let's see, what's the man's first name? George C. Southworth. The book is called Principles and Applications of Waveguide Transmission. Kind of a long title. The book has, 600 and some odd pages. 1915 D-Van No String Company. 1950 issue. An oldie, but a goodie. If you go to page 403, you begin the section on horns, and it goes on for 20 consecutive pages. From 403 to 423, nothing but horns. Everything you want to know about horns. How wide, how narrow, how big, how long, and whatever. And roughly half the horns there are circular horns, and half, maybe three-quarters of the horns, are rectangular. There's a lot of both kinds. And so that's a classic work where somebody put a lot of man hours into literally fabricating horns of every possible shape, size, ellipticity, roundness, squareness, whatever, and plotted the patterns and other characteristics. So you want to know about horns, you want to try to get a copy of the Southwards. A good technical library should have it. Not an easy buy book to buy. I would guess that used book sources, Amazon or whatever, probably have it from time to time, because various people will consider the book so valuable, even though it is 57 years old, it represents a massive amount of work on certain microwave subjects. There's a section in there that will show you, if your eyes could see the wave going down a waveguide, and if you have a waveguide used in the primary mode or the higher harmonic mode, what would the wave look like? These look like computer-generated pictures. But because this work was done in the middle 40s, when there was no computer-generated equipment, it was really done by some other very laborious technique. But it's all there. Lots and lots of pictures. It's amazing how good that book is, even though it's so old. So I do recommend it. And maybe that'll help. If you really want to know about horns, read Southwards. K2KEY, KTYYW.
Okay, very good. Thank you. This is K2KEY, Yacht 6, the Synod book, Copper Pipe, Synwall Copper Pipe, again. I wanted to emphasize that, we use that as a type of Tesla, Igeri Copper Pipe. And basically, I guess, if you want the shape of the of this loop, I guess you could call it like an octagon shape. Like I say, 45-degree elbows. And the importance of the whole importance of it really is that everything is soldered together. That's why we use copper pipe, so we solder together. And of course, by soldering it together, you will definitely increase the Q of this antenna. It's got to be soldered together. Yes, here I see, I'm reading on, and it says, do I have to have a way of soldering this pipe together? Yes, I'll have to have a torch, or the availability of a torch, and I would suggest that, like we did, we use silver solder to put together. Very important to have good joints with the minimum resistance at the joints, otherwise it will not work. That's basically what it comes down to. All right, so I think we covered that. Go on, over.
If you think of another good one, go for it, Mel.
Okay, look. Hold on. There's a comment. There's a comment. Keep coming and coming. I knew we opened up Pandora's box a few weeks ago. I figured it was going to get some of these. Here we go again. Yak, this has been going on since I don't know how many years now. The Aggie versus the Quad. Both antennas I use on 6 meters. Okay. If you want the most bang for your buck, you use something like a bi-square antenna, which essentially is a type of quad on end. And, that will work better than a Yagi. What have we got here? Yeah, I'm reading this over. A whole thing. I got quite a bit of information here that this person sent me about the performance of a Yagi versus a quad on 6 meters. Dick, I don't know if you want to take that up, over.
Okay, I've never built a cubical quad for 6, but a few of my friends have. I have built 6-element Yagis for 6 meters, I seem to remember it was like 20-foot long boom. And as an occupation for the last 5 years, I've been building, studying, and patenting the IP antenna. You go to the U.S. Patent Office, and I can show you a patent on a Yagi antenna of mine. I don't even know if I can... I think I will be able to find the number of the actual patent itself, but you just look up my last name, and you'll find the patent on a Yagi antenna. Everything I know about Yagi tells me that when I go from a dipole-like element to a cubical quad-like element, I got to remember now what the bi-square looks like. I know it's a little bit different. A cubical quad versus dipole, for a large number of elements, six or more elements, I say there is zero difference. A number of us did some pretty serious comparisons on 432 megacycles at the antenna game competition in the late 60s, early 70s of the East Coast VHF Society and Trenton State College, other places like that. Very, very little difference if there is any. If you prefer the mechanical construction of a cubical quad as opposed to a conventional dipole, go for it. Loops, triangles, squares, it almost doesn't matter. When you get up to frequencies like 1296, 900 megs and above, there is an advantage for loop-like antennas as opposed to dipole-like Yagi antennas. The advantage is that when the dew forms on the antenna on certain high humidity mornings, dew drops will wind their way by gravity toward the center of the loop where the boom is, where the voltage is very low, and has no effect. Whereas a dipole-like antenna at 900, 1296, 2304, a dipole-like Yagi antenna, the drops of dew and the great big drops of water on the tips of the antenna tune the antenna to such a lower frequency that the antenna starts firing in the wrong direction, as I think Mel was saying earlier. So quads and loops have that advantage. But when it comes to a gain advantage, everyone wants to believe, because the resonant loop of a cubical quad is the equivalent of an upper V-shaped dipole, inverted V, and the lower non-inverted V. And so you want to believe that there are two elements stacked one above the other, and therefore you have the equivalent of two Yagis stacked above the other. Well, in the case of a cubical quad, the stacking distance is so small that the increase in potential effective capture area is extremely small. This is an argument that's been going on for multiple decades. It's an argument that's been going on for multiple decades among ham radio operators. You could say that the jury is still out. Various guys have done some pretty serious measurements to try to confirm one way or the other. And all of my reading of the subject tells me if there is a difference, the difference is small. The bottom line is, if you prefer the mechanical construction with a bamboo pole and the wire and the support mechanism of a cubical quad, as opposed to the other mechanical construction technique of a flat-out Yagi with a dipole-like element, if you prefer that, go for it. If you think you're going to get more gain, and if it makes you happy, go for it. But when it comes to real measurement in a real antenna range, I guarantee you the difference is awfully small. For a two or three element Yagi, maybe you're going to find a couple of tenths of a dB of difference. For five, six elements, I don't think with laboratory test equipment, with each antenna being well built, you can measure a significant difference. That's my take on it. But it's an opinion. It's an opinion based on a fair amount of experience, quite a bit of laboratory experiment, but it's not the last word. I'm not going to say absolutely positively that's the only way you can think about this. But I am giving you the benefit of what experience I've had and what I think is the truth. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, the controversy, who really lit the controversy up and caused this to go on was that article that was, or quite a number of articles that Doug D. Moore printed some years ago, and I believe it's in, I don't remember, the magazine, one of those magazines. not USD, but he was working for one of the other magazines, and they asked him to finally try to put this to rest, you know, which is the better antenna, element to element or whatever. And he wrote a thing called the quad-quad array. I remember reading it, and he came up with the opinion that with a quad, you have less QSD, and also the minimal side lobe and much greater front-to-side ratio than any characteristic of a Yagi of equal element. You want to make a comment on that, Dick? Over.
Yes, I do. One thing I think of the man's name you just mentioned. Is it Doug DeMore?
Roger.
Yeah, a very respected, Doug DeMore, a very respected man, written a lot of darn good articles. And that means he has an extremely high hit ratio. However, nobody's at the 1,000. I believe there is the possibility Doug is wrong on this one. Because the range that was available, the antenna range that was available to Doug at the time, by modern standards, was less than ideal. I didn't say it's bad. I just said it was less than ideal. There were antenna range setup techniques for reflective ground plane antenna range and calibration procedures that are now known, that were not as well known when Doug did that experiment. For him to claim that the gain is higher and the side lobes are lower, sounds like that antenna is better. But the side lobes are highly misunderstood. Common sense would lead you to believe that an antenna with the highest possible gain will have zero side lobes, because the side lobes, with good common sense, represent wasted energy. Everyone believes that all the energy you put into the side lobes, and the energy you put into the side lobes is real. Everyone believes that energy put into the side lobes is wasted energy. It's off in a direction that's not as desirable at this time when you're trying to squirt the antenna in a particular direction as we are adjusting the bore side of the antenna, the main lobe. Okay. If you believe that, you've got a problem, because the aperture efficiencies of the horns and parabolic dishes that most hams have used and most commercial installations have used fall into the category of 55 to, let's say, 70% aperture efficiency. The definition of aperture efficiency is what is the physical area of the area type antenna. Area type antenna means horn-like, parabolic reflector-like. In other words, your eye can see the real area of the antenna. And when you take that area and you go to the formula telling you what is the potential gain for that amount of area, and then you go and measure the gain that you've really got, not in decibels, but in a hard number, an anti-log number, you'll find out you come up with, let's say, 60% of the gain that you could get for that area. So our amateur antennas have 60% aperture efficiency. Are there any antennas out there with near 100% aperture efficiency? Answer is absolutely yes. As the antenna gets larger and larger in number of wavelengths, if you're smart enough, the aperture efficiency continuously increases. Take it to the limit. An optical parabolic reflector telescope like Mount Palomar, or the Hubble Space Telescope, you study the aperture efficiency of that, and it's an extremely high number, probably 97%. Now you study the side lobe levels of that antenna with 97% efficiency. The first side lobe is 13.5 dB down. The second side lobe is 17.5 dB down. Third side lobe is 23 dB down, and so on. When you have a round aperture with maximum efficiency, Mother Nature dictates you will have side lobes of that level. You can redesign the antenna, and you can knock down those side lobes. When you do that, the gain decreases. At first you say, hey, I'm taking the energy of the side lobe and putting it into the main lobe. Well, because of all the changes you've got to do to make the side lobes go away, it makes the gain of the antenna, it makes the main lobe of the antenna wider and the gain lower. So you make the side lobes weaker, the antenna goes down. You make the side lobes stronger, the gain goes down. You make the side lobes those exact magic numbers, and you get maximum gain. So, how did I get on this particular one? I'm wondering what the question was. I may have drifted off to one side here, Bill. That brings me back on target. Go ahead.
You had a controversy about the business of the lobes, you know, the difference between a quad and a Yagi as far as side lobes that go.
Right on target. Okay, now I know where it was going. So when Doug DeMora claimed, and this is one of these self-fulfilling prophecies, in other words, so many amateurs for so many years on the 20-meter band and the 80-meter band told each other, cubicle quads have higher gain and lower side loads and higher aperture efficiency and better front-to-back ratio. They all told each other that. It became a religion. It didn't require a confirmation. They made a leap of faith and believed it. And so anybody who did an experiment, no matter what the data said, they reported that because that was the acceptable answer. So lower side lobes is not necessarily better. Now, there are certain environments, like if you're designing a radar antenna, and that radar dish is sweeping around in azimuth, and you would like the target of those aircraft that show up on the radar screen to appear once and not appear on multiple times at multiple azimuth, you design an antenna with very low side lobes. You sacrifice gain in the process. You make the gain a backup by making the dish bigger. So the aperture efficiency of a good radar antenna is lower, not higher, than you could get with your backyard tuning of a parabolic dish antenna, simply because they need side lobes down to get rid of azimuthal ambiguities. So, and Mr. Sebick, I can't think of his first name right now, has written a whole series of articles of very deep computer modeling he's done to eliminate side lobes. And if you look at his antenna pattern, the gain he's got for the number of elements he's using is lower than had he not done that. He didn't worry about the fact that the gain fell down. He just thought that the main thing he was seeking was to get rid of side lobes, because he also believed that they are detrimental. If you go to the Roadrunner website, K5RMG, if you go to that Roadrunner website, I think it's k5rmg.org or .net, I'm not sure which, and you go to the so-called K2RIW corner. I've published a number of articles on the microwave reflector on this subject, a listserv of microwave enthusiasts. I published articles on this subject, and you go there and you'll find this article on the desirable side lobe levels that should be there. Now, that article got published in the United Kingdom and got published in Australia. It hasn't been published in the United States. It was submitted as an article to the United States, and it didn't get published. No one's interested in that subject. It's contrary to the common belief, if you know what I mean. So I think Doug could be in error. A sincere guy, he means well. He could be in error because of the time he lived in and the methods by which he was forced to make the measurements. I'm not yet convinced that it has better front-to-back, a better side lobe level, and a higher gain for the amount of material, for the number of elements in question. And the people who have truly done an objective side-by-side test can't find a substantial difference. I'm led to believe that there is a difference. It's small. And so the bottom line, I think, is choose the method of physical construction that you prefer and go for it. But if you're choosing one over the other because you think one's got a huge gain improvement, pattern improvement, front-to-back improvement, I'm very doubtful. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. I knew we opened up Pandora's box, like I said, when we came up with this. Here's one also about this. I don't even know if I should continue with all this here. Do you know about the experiment? Uh-huh. This one here, he says, do you know about the experiment that was done at Pepperdine University in Malibu, California by Dr. Lindsay on the same subject of Yagis versus Quad? Are you familiar with this, Dick? Because I got a whole dissertation on it here over.
No, Lindsay I'm not familiar with. I am familiar with K6, is it YMC? No, I'm having trouble remembering the call that is now the guy who, designed the Quad Yagi. Another very sincere guy. And he and I were in the same antenna game competition one time at East Coast VHS Society. And it was interesting. In the case of the Quad Yagi, people wanted to believe that a cubical quad driven element and cubical quad reflector and the rest of the elements, ordinary Yagi dipole-like elements, would be a superior antenna. Very nice belief, but it didn't turn out to be true. The Lindsay article, if you give me the reference, I'll read it. But I'm starting off skeptical. I'd also like to know, before I read the article, is he claiming a tenth of a dB of difference, or is he claiming 2.5 dB of difference? If it's 2.5 and it's real, hey, we're talking about a breakthrough. If it's a tenth of a dB difference, I'm worried because he might be in the realm of measurement accuracy. Back to you, Mel. Is the reference given?
Sure is, boy. This guy gave us things I could say. He really poured it on here. I'm trying to read over some of it quickly. Well, there's quite a bit. Yeah, J.E. Lindsay, IEEE transaction on antennas. And it was, I don't know if you're going to find it, believe me. Back to 1967, September 1967, proceedings of the IEEE.
Hey, question of Wayne Overbeck,
Wayne Overbeck, that's the name. Thank you, Rich. Okay, the fact that this is published in IEEE Antennas and Propagation, 1967 September. Okay, now it's beginning to sound a lot more substantial. Now I'm going to worry about whether or not he who read the article interpreted the words correctly. But in the case of the AP, in which I'm a member of the Antennas and Propagation Society for 35 years, I've been subscribing to the journal that long. I've been paying my dues. And reading it, I might even have that very issue. I'm going to try to find it. September 67, Antennas and Propagation. That particular journal, a peer-reviewed, serious journal, for the most part, what's written there is traceable to the Bureau, traceable to the NIST. And so now it's much harder to say, hey, these guys did measurement error, because they have a review committee that's second to none. I mean, there's a bunch of experts that will review each one of those articles before it's allowed to be published. And they find out, was the right calibration procedure used? Was the right testing procedure used? Was the right conclusion used? Was the right error assessment used? And so on. And that's a real scientific journal. Okay. Now you're talking about something we can't dismiss, though, Mel. I'm going to have to read it. J.E. Lindsay, 1967, September, Antennas and Propagation. And so, if I understand correctly, a comparison of quad and Yagi dipole-like elements were made, and did the author of the email to you indicate the number of decibels of difference in gain for how many elements at what frequency? I wonder if any of those details are there. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, I got the whole thing here. Yeah, well, Wayne Overbeck, I remember reading his whole series on that. That was the evolution of the VHF Quaggy, the one I built, the Quaggy stick. I remember quite a bit about that. I used that Quaggy on 432 and it worked. I'll tell you, it worked quite well on that stick, you know, with the wooden boom and everything, and easily put together, and easily tuned, and well, you need a bunch of wire hangers put together, and it was amazing how well it performed. Let's see. Let me read over here some of the stuff. Okay, here. Dr. Lindsay, was necessary for the Aggie to have 1.8 times the boom length of a quad to equal its forward gain. Now, imagine that plane stresses, you don't intend, if you don't increase the boom length on a Yagi 1.8 times,